Hello, I'm Richard Dockrer. I'm a writer and consultant helping people to stand back and examine the big picture of life, human beings, politics, society and ideas. I'm the founder and director of the not-for-profit Life Squared and the social change agency ChangeStar. In this podcast series, I want to challenge your views of how we, human beings, think and behave. Most of us have a completely inaccurate view of the creatures we are, and the truth, revealed by researchers over recent decades, is mind-blowing and could change how we think about our lives and societies. In each episode, I'll be joined by an expert psychologist to explore one of humanity's biggest hopes or challenges, including seeking global peace, tackling the spread of misinformation, and preventing climate change. We'll ask whether each aim is realistic, given the creatures we are, and if we can't achieve them, what's the best we can hope for? In this episode, I'm talking to Professor Roy Baumeister about self-discipline and willpower. We'll explore how much control we really have over our thinking and behaviour, how self-esteem can help us in life, and how we can strengthen our own self-discipline as well as other people's, such as that of our children. Professor Baumeister is Professor of Psychology at the University of Queensland in Australia. His research explores how we think about the self and why we feel and act the way we do. He's especially known for his work on the subjects of willpower, self-control, and self-esteem, and how they relate to human morality and success. Here's the conversation. I hope you enjoy it. So the question this week is, how much self-discipline do we really have? And I think a good place to start on this, Roy, would be just to ask the question, what do we mean by self-discipline? And how does that perhaps relate to the other idea of willpower?
All right. Self-discipline would be part of the category of self-control, which is our capacity for changing ourselves, for changing responses, changing thoughts, changing feelings, performance to maximize your performance. Often self-discipline is important for that, such as continuing to work when you're tired and you don't feel like continuing. Well, impulse control, of course, is a big one. Self-discipline to restrain yourself from indulging in pleasures that may be tempting now, but down the road you'll be sorry. So self-discipline helps merge the self across time. Most of the other creatures, including those from whom we evolved, live just in the present. So the mind there is just designed to act on its strongest impulse because, well, do what you most feel like. If you're afraid, run away. If you're hungry, eat that food. But we have the capacity to project into the future and bring it back to the present and say, well, I do want that now, but I'll be sorry if I act on that. So that's a much more complicated decision process and a process of controlling action. I think that's what leads to the ideas of free will to set us apart from animals, or at least that's one of the components of free will. We don't have to act on our strongest feelings at the very moment. And often being a civilized being means learning to restrain your feelings and your impulses and desires to follow the rules which enable society to flourish.
It feels like one of the central questions perhaps we need to tackle in this episode, given some of the things we've talked about in previous episodes, is this idea that in recent decades in psychology, you know, we've learnt the idea that we're less rational creatures than we think we are. And that, you know, we're more vulnerable to external influence, whether it's from social norms or our tribal behavior towards in-groups and out-groups. And so given all of that, you know, how much control can we actually exert upon ourselves, on our thinking and behavior?
Well, potentially quite a bit, but the capacity is limited. So this self-control, I mean, you know, the brain, I'm not a brain expert, but the brain evolved from the back to the front. The back of the brain has the simple wanting and feeling parts, and these new powers to override and engage in rational thought and to think, well, I'll be sorry someday if I do this now, and therefore I should do something else now. That's the front part. Conceptually, it's set on top of the basic animal that's inside us. We are animals. We are more than animals, but we are still animals. So what you're saying, this limited rationality, yes, we have the power, the capability for rational thought. Do we use it all the time? No, we certainly don't. And it takes energy and effort to apply it, especially when it means going against what the animal inside us feels like doing right now. So I see it, the glass is very much half full and half empty in terms of how much self-control people have and self-discipline. We have a lot more than the animals from whom we evolved, but we have a lot less than we might ideally like to have. I mean, many people list self-control as one of their biggest weaknesses and failings, and few people list it as one of their greatest strengths. So people are focusing on, well, life would be a lot better if I were better at self-discipline.
The evidence does suggest, does it not, that actually by having a greater propensity for self-discipline is likely to bring you greater success in life. And I don't mean that necessarily material, but in terms of how life works out for you.
Oh, yes, there's a great deal of data tracking people over a long period of time. I covered a lot of that when I was writing that book on willpower, which is trying to pull together the research for a general audience. And it was just striking how much better people are with good self-control. Even self-control rated by the school teacher when the child is 9 years old predicts all sorts of adult outcomes, like having a happy marriage and not being arrested for a crime and not smoking and having a job and making more money, all sorts of these things. I mean, you mentioned material success. It leads to better material success. People with good self-control do better in school and in work. And as I said, end up making more money. Also, they're more popular. They have better, more stable relationships, fewer behavioral problems. They even live longer at the far end. So mental, physical health, all these things benefit. And along the way, they're happier. I mean, that was another issue, this self-discipline, just sort of this, we called it the Puritan hypothesis. I know in the UK, you had Puritans in charge for a while. In the US, they were in charge for much longer and left a bigger stamp on our national psyche. And their stereotype, which is not entirely fair, but partly is that they slogged through life in a joyless fashion, just doing their duty and frowning on anyone who had too much pleasure. So we wondered, is self-discipline really just a revival of Puritanism? But no, they are happier. There are two main ways of measuring happiness. You can ask people, sort of bird's eye view, are you satisfied with your life in general? Or it's much more expensive in terms of research. You can interrupt people at random moments across their days and weeks and saying, how do you feel right now? And count the positive and negative emotions. But by either measure, people with good self-control are happier. So it makes life better. And there are reasons for this. Poor self-control, people make a lot of problems for themselves. They dig themselves into a hole. I mean, if you don't pay the bill on time, then you know, your car is repossessed or your electricity is shut off or your phone doesn't work anymore. And then you have to deal with that. Or with poor self-control, you say something to your romantic partner that is sort of mean and cruel. Then you have to undo that because you've got all the problems from that. So simply not creating problems for yourself. The easiest way to reduce your stress in life that you have control over is to stop making a mess and creating your own problems. And self-control really seems to shine for that.
We can see quite big differences in people's capacity for self-control at quite an early age. Could you describe what factors might be influencing our capacity for self-control?
Well, there's nature and nurture. Most psychological traits have some genetic component, so probably some people have a head start just on the genes they inherit from their parents. But the environment matters too. You can't really do much about your genes, but you can certainly, with parents, even just having in your mind that you want your children to have good self-control and self-discipline, thinking of that as your goal, that's really helpful. I think we got off on the wrong direction back about 30, 40 years ago with the self-esteem movement, and suddenly everyone worried that their children didn't have enough self-esteem. Actually, children start off with plenty of self-esteem. Most of them think they can do all kinds of things. They're going to grow up and be a movie star and a rich person and a variety of other things as well. So as long as you don't stomp on the child's self-esteem and tell the child you're worthless, they'll be fine there. In practice, the self-esteem concern has made parents reluctant to criticize their children. And I think that's unfortunate, because to cultivate self-discipline, that means you have to hold up clear standards and criticize the child who falls short and reward the child who lives up to it. So having that in your mind, it's clear both reward and punishment are helpful. Severe punishment is not needed. Unfortunately, what some parents do is that they'll overlook certain misbehaviors for a while, and then when it gets too bad, then they'll punish the child severely. And that's really the worst thing to do. Severe punishments alienate the child. And it also, I'm doing basically the same thing I did last week when you just laughed, and now you're punishing me severely. So consistent standards, immediate punishment, but often a very mild one, will be sufficient if you make it clear that you don't tolerate that. And then again, reward the good behaviors. I remember seeing a mother say to a child, I know you were upset back there when you were playing with the other kids and they wouldn't share their toys with you. I know you were upset about that, but it was very good that you didn't scream or cry or make a tantrum, that you just went along with it. I really am proud of you for doing that. So this mother noticed an act of self-control, and it's easy to overlook that because the child didn't make a scene, but you can tell you were upset and yet you controlled yourself, and praising the child for that, that's the kind of thing that helps build self-control. Having clear standards, the parents ideally should agree on how they want the child to behave, and immediately disapprove when the child tests the limits. That's the sort of thing that really, really, I think, helps.
And are there certain circumstances in which we might show greater or less self-discipline than others? Or are those quite personal? So for someone, it might be related to food, or for someone else it might be related to money, or are there some sort of categories of external circumstance in which everybody struggles with and needs a little bit more help with?
We need to understand that the capacity for self-control is a single thing, but it's a limited, so people can apply it to different things. I mean, some people will say, I have good self-control for keeping my apartment clean, but bad self-control for deadlines at work, things like that. But it's the same capacity, the same self-control. It's just some people put it into one thing and other people apply it elsewhere. Much of my research has found that willpower is a limited resource, and that after people use it, they don't have as much again. So once you understand that, and you understand also that external demands for decision-making, for self-discipline and self-control, that they will take away from your ability to do other things. So people who are, say, trying to quit smoking and go on a diet to lose weight at the same time, well, they tend to do a bad job at both, because both of those take a considerable amount of willpower. They're also unpleasant to live with while they're doing this because they don't control their thoughts and feelings that well, and they'll say nasty things and they're cranky and grumpy.
Something else will go, so that you're trying to sort of keep this pressure up on these things, but actually something else is you're going to let other things slip in your self-control.
Yes, trying to deal with those. Right. That's correct. So once you understand that it's a limited power, then you want to use it judiciously. You probably have more in the morning when you've had a good sleep and a good breakfast. Over the course of the day, it tends to get used, especially if there are many challenges and demands. And remember, it's also used for decision-making, planning. So tasks like that will weaken your self-control. I had a postdoc who was getting married, and she did the bridal registry thing where you go to a nice store and you indicate all the presents you would like to get. And she said, oh, when I was done with that, you could have talked me into anything. I was completely depleted just making all those decisions about what shape of a gravy boat do you want and what should be the design on the spoons. And just one decision after another, that depletes your willpower as well. So that's not the time to go making choices or risk getting into a fight with your partner. Likewise, I've been studying addiction, and people relapse when they're under stress. This is hardly a new insight, but we can understand why, because, say, stress at work or having a relationship go bad where you're having a lot of fights and having to negotiate the breakup, these will sap and deplete your willpower, your energy. So you don't have as much to keep up your self-discipline in other areas, such as jogging and flossing. And if you also quit smoking or quit some other addiction, to maintain abstinence is extra hard at times like that.
So if you've got a major project on your hands that you really want to exercise self-discipline on, say giving up smoking, for example, you've mm-hmm. got to be prepared to sort of move a lot more of your chips into that particular area and be prepared for it to fall back on some other areas. And it's about prioritizing your projects for self-discipline in some ways, is it?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Don't undertake that exactly when you're about to be in charge of a demanding new initiative at the office. Or again, the relationship is starting or ending or something that's taking a lot of energy there. If you're going to quit smoking, which is one of the hardest things that people do, do it when you're basically at peace with the world in all other respects.
It's interesting that we're talking about some of these things, perhaps some of it relating to food, some of it relating to smoking, because some of these are quite sort of physiological instincts and processes. Is part of this about using your rationality, your sort of manual mode, to override your automatic mode a little bit?
Yes, but it's more than just the rational thinking part of it. It's applying the results of rational thought. I remember the philosopher Searle, in his book Rationality and Action, made a very nice point that everybody thinks of humans as at least partly rational, and we are certainly capable of rational, but rationality implies some degree of free will. Otherwise, you'd be able to rationally think, I should do this, but you wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So you need at least enough free will so that once you figure out what's the best thing to do, you can do that instead of what the animal inside you feels like doing.
You've already given a couple of interesting examples of how we can improve our capacity for self-discipline. I wonder if we could perhaps explore any more sort of practical examples of how people might go about that then, if they wanted to improve their self-discipline, either on a particular issue or just more generally.
Well, the analogy that's served me well through 30 years of research on this is that self-control seems to be like a muscle. So yes, when you use it to cope with some demand, then it's tired, just as a muscle is tired after exertion. It needs a little while to recover. But also like a muscle, it can get stronger with exercise. So I think there's a famous passage in William James's writing that you should just discipline yourself to do something difficult each day, and then you will become stronger. And when challenges do arise, you'll be able to stand up and meet them while everyone else is blowing away like chaff in the wind. William James was a great thinker who lived a century ago, and that was sort of at the end of the Victorian period. And the Victorians thought of this as building character. We mostly rebelled, especially my generation, wanted to embrace the hippie lifestyle and do all sorts of wild things. So it was a little funny to come back around and say, well, the Victorians had a good point that yes, building character is a real thing. There's recently a couple other scholars have done meta-analyses where you combine the results of many different studies and concluded that yes, that self-control can be improved with these training exercises. Make yourself better. Pick some area for self-improvement. Implement that. In our studies, we borrow exercises, at least in mine, from meditation and so on. We just assign people to do random things to change. And I wouldn't necessarily advise other people to do that, but for research purposes, it's the purest, because there's no other baggage going with it. So we have things like telling people, try using, if you're right-handed, use your left hand for a variety of things. Opening doors, drinking from a cup, brushing your teeth, using a computer mouse. The point is, you'll have a habit to do these with the right hand, and so you override that habit and use your left hand. This works for a while. After it becomes habit to use your left hand, then it doesn't exercise your self-control muscle anymore. And there are things you can do with speech as well. Discipline yourself to not to use curse words in front of the children, or to speak in complete sentences. Or another is not to use abbreviations in shop talk, but say everything by its full name. Again, the point is just that you watch yourself when you're about to do something, you override that and change and make yourself do something different. That's the muscle that you're exercising, so that when it comes to resisting eating too much chocolate when you're on a diet or something like that, that you have that power and you've cultivated it.
Are we generally realistic in our assessments of how much self-discipline we each have? Or do people tend to overestimate how much self-discipline they've got?
I don't know the answer to that. I know people often recognize self-control as a problem they have. I know that people in general tend to overestimate their good traits in lots of things. I mean, if someone rates his self-control as 7 on a 10-point scale, how would we show that the reality is 5?
Another question I was fascinated to understand is that we've talked so far about the consequences that greater self-control could have for us as individuals, just in aspects of our day-to-day lives. Do you see that there is almost sort of we have a bit of a deficit of self-control in the modern world as human beings? And if so, how do you think we could actually improve that? Do you think it would actually do us good to be teaching greater self-control, for example, in institutions?
Yes, I think societies that have cultivated self-control have been more successful than others. It's sensitive to talk about because it sort of implies that some cultures are more successful than others, but it's true. And the British Empire conquered the world, large parts of it, in part because its people were very disciplined. There's one argument that the downward mobility in British society moved sort of well-trained, well-disciplined people from the upper class, like the third and fourth children, down to lower levels of society, and then made a workforce possible that would obey the rules and that would use the equipment and show up on time, and thus facilitated the Industrial Revolution. So I think the historical record does suggest, indeed, that better self-discipline is better for society as well as for the individual members of it. There are people arguing about climate aspects, that people who lived, say, in Northern Europe, you had to be prepared to get through a long, cold winter. You had to plan ahead and restrict today. Whereas if you lived at the equator, which most of the other apes just live spread around the equator because food is readily available all the time. You can go to a banana tree and pick a banana and you won't starve. So you don't have to plan ahead. You don't have to do all the other things that one needs to survive in a harsh and challenging environment. So again, building self-control is good for individuals and good for society.
Presumably, though, in a society, I mean, some of the things that you've talked about there, they border on sort of militaristic tendencies of actually subjugating people and their freedom. So there is clearly a balance to be struck between the desire for a reasonable level of self-discipline, but actually to have a political settlement which values people's freedom.
Yes, well, you can use your freedom more effectively with good self-discipline, and indeed strict government control is often used to cope with a lack of self-discipline in the individual members. But yes, I'm totally in favor of non-repressive governments.
The solution is possibly more than to try and help people to instill greater self-discipline in themselves, obviously within a free and democratic society.
Yes. When I speak about free will, when I sometimes put up a slide saying free will is for following rules, because it challenges people. Many people think of freedom as being able to do what you want with no rules. But any animal out in the forest can do that. It doesn't take an advanced psychological power to be able to do what you want with no rules. But to operate in an environment where there are rules and still take care of yourself and get what you want and contribute to the social enterprise, that's what takes self-control and free will.
Final question. Where do you see all this going in the future? Do you see human beings, you know, building themselves through society as sort of a tendency to increase their self-discipline? Do you think that is something that we will be doing, or do you think we'll pull it back? Where do you think it's likely to go?
Well, that's hard. I forget who said, never make predictions, especially about the future. We certainly have been in Western civilization in a downward trend in terms of self-discipline. There's more emphasis on immediate gratification, advertising, the rich availability of immediate pleasures. Those always appeal to the animal self, and it's hard to get people to restrict that. On the other hand, the positive value of self-control does come apparent from time to time. So it is possible we will rediscover it again and start to raise our children with more of an eye to self-control than to their happiness and self-esteem. The influence of technology is unpredictable in this regard. As cameras start to proliferate, a lot of impulsive crimes are really disappearing because people know they will be seen and identified. And so that can be a positive force toward cultivating self-control, even among people who are brought up to think they're entitled to gratify their desires in an immediate fashion. So if technology can help rather than hurt, and technology certainly works both ways, it offers us immediate impulsive gratification. But as I said, it can also hold you responsible for things that you did and make people more disciplined and can be a positive force in that way. That's hard to predict.
If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to the whole series from wherever you get your podcasts or via my website, richarddockra.com. While you're there, you can check out my other podcasts and books and sign up for my monthly newsletter containing interesting ideas and updates. Thanks for listening.